Hey, it's Elisa Monjadas, Managing Director of Stories Bureau, and this is my co-host, Creative Director of Stories Bureau.
Hey, everyone, I'm Corey Grushka, and this is B2B Creatively, where we want to talk about all things B2B creative, from trends to best practices, campaigns that succeeded.
So that all of us together can learn how to B2B creatively.
If you're a marketer, you'll learn how to be more creative, and if you're a creative, we're going to make you more strategic. Elisa, I'm pumped for this conversation today. But before we get there, I want to talk a little bit about you.
Oh, my favorite topic.
Your favorite. This is B2B Creatively. So, and you are a creative, among other things. And I want to get your thoughts on something, given that you're an entrepreneur with me. You were a VP of marketing in the B2B space. You are a podcaster, you are an executive coach, and you've had a bunch of other creative endeavors, entrepreneurial, otherwise. So given that we're podcasting about B2B creatively, what is important about creativity in business? How is creativity manifest in business?
Thank you for naming my little history.
My pleasure. Yeah, this is about you.
For me personally, I have to have some kind of creative outlet in anything I'm doing, which is why there's a variety of things on my LinkedIn. I get bored really easily. And because I get bored, I like to have challenges always. I always want to do something new. I always want to try something new. And a lot of those challenges, if I were to like look back through my career, were creative challenges. Like I had never done a podcast before and I thought that would be cool. I've never done food blogging. I thought that would be cool. I've never had a creative agency. That seems fun. And so I think there's something about like creativity for me personally and then creativity to share with others. Those are, I would say, are themes in my life. So for business, it keeps things fresh and alive because for Stories Bureau sake, like I want fresh, cool designs. I want like the cutting edge technology. I want like fun. And so like for me personally, I think that translates into like what our business looks like and how we operate.
It does. And we're a creative agency doing a creative podcast dealing with creativity. So cool. All right. With that as a segue.
Should we take a shot every time we say creative?
I think so.
Evidently.
Jacob, welcome. Our guest today is a creative. Everybody go! turned founder of a tech B2B startup that was acquired by Equinix. And we actually met when you were there in a period post-acquisition where you were our client. And you've since left to start a VC fund, which is a super interesting topic of conversation. And I'm really eager to hear your insights on all things, but also entrepreneurship, business, B2B, and of course, Elisa?
Creativity.
Got it.
Creatively, in this case.
I'm Jacob Smith. I'm co-founder of Humans of the Internet, which is a venture community based in New York City, investing in startups who are trying to change the world with digital infrastructure, open source software, or bend the curve on sustainability. Corey, you mentioned I started my career not in the B2B tech startup world, but ended up there. Grew up in Southern California, learned to play music, got into music. That took me into figuring out how to pay my bills, which got me into starting my own creative agency, which got me into helping people fix their businesses and grow their businesses, which ultimately led to me starting a tech startup, venture-backed, and then growing that and selling that. And so that journey for me has also been about creativity. So
I've never heard anyone say they played music for money, like to make money.
No.
What?
Had to make money to pay for the music. It's a reverse psychology thing.
How is the music piece kind of, how has creativity impacted your business career, Jacob?
Yeah, it was funny. You asked that question at the beginning. I think that business is inherently about creating. I got a quote the other day from my son. He likes Breaking Bad. And I believe the opening episode, Walter White's a chemistry teacher. And he says, chemistry is about change.
Ooh.
You know, gets everyone riled up, obviously. For me, business is about creation. You know, otherwise it's functional. And that's not the kind of thing I'm interested in so much, although that's a big part of running a business. And also the part of the world that, or the, you know, the way the world works now, it needs evolution and change. And business is often a way to do that. But for me, I started my process as a creative artist, which is, you know, which taught me, and I think other people who have gone really far with something like music or art or sports, or maybe even joined like the military, you kind of take things to a really high level. And the ingredients there are kind of hard to teach, but they include things like collaboration, learning where to compromise, where to lead, how to make many voices kind of sound like one, you know, how to show up on time with your homework done or your part learned, or, you know, that sense of accountability, that sense of growth, receiving criticism and taking it as a learning opportunity. All those things are things you learn very fluidly as a creative person because it's just the currency. And I found those to be ridiculously important in business and especially in an entrepreneurial setting. And they're extremely hard to teach.
The creativity, creation connection, I never even thought about that idea, but it's so true, right? Because it's like you create when you start a business. And if you're going to grow, you have to constantly create, right?
You know, if you go back and look at the list of Fortune 500 companies and how long they stayed in the Fortune 500.
Totally.
You know, it's just gone from, you know, an average of 15 years to 11 years to 7 years to five, you know, just keeps getting compressed because the competitive environment, technology, you know, the world is more flat. Things just come in and out more often. So if you're not changing, you're dying, right? It's like, it's definitely part of it. I think that that's an inherently entrepreneurial spirit. But it applies to large businesses as well because they have to reinvent themselves or, you know, someone else will do it to them.
It's interesting when you were talking about being a musician and showing up on time and having discipline. My dad's a musician and I think he has all those qualities that he's tried to instill in me. I've tried.
That's good.
but tell us a little bit more about like your musical career because you were legit, yeah. Like you weren't a hobby.
Actual professional.
Yeah. I actually played music for money for a while. So I studied the bassoon. I don't know if anyone really knows what the bassoon is, but either way, it's a woodwind instrument. It's a double reed instrument. And it was my second instrument because the saxophone was my first love, right? I heard some Debbie Gibson song in the late 80s and thought I needed to play the saxophone. I'm sure it was a great idea. You know, Kenny G.
I did wear a Debbie Gibson hat in the early 90s.
You had one. Yeah, it's good. There's all kinds of things we could go into there. So I played the saxophone, which my brother played the bass and my sister played the violin. And so on Thursday nights, they went to the orchestra, the youth orchestra, and played there. And there's no saxophone in the orchestra. So I was like, what could I play to be in the orchestra? And funny enough, there was no one playing the bassoon. So it was like automatic first chair. It was like,
amazing.
I'll play the bassoon. And then I realized why no one played the bassoon. It was very complicated. I just kind of got hooked into less the actual act of being a musician than the craft of something. And sort of, you know, the attention that you could give to it. Spending that much time with a teacher, like one teacher versus, you know, you're one in the class of 30. It was like really indulgent, but I loved it. And that was really a mentor to me. He actually gave me that sensibility. He was a freelance musician in Hollywood. I don't know what your dad did, but he said the key to life and music is to show up on time and don't play in the rests. And I was like, you know, I was young. I didn't quite understand that, but it's certainly been a guiding light for me as I kind of tried to take that further. So long story short, I went to college. I went to Carnegie Mellon. By the skin of my teeth, I got in through the music department, but hung out in the computer science department for fun and got an English degree while I was there. Probably would never have gotten in if I hadn't played music. And then moved to Philadelphia, got a master's at Temple University, and started playing in the opera, which is what I really loved. I love playing in the opera. There's a few hundred people working together at once to do one thing. You know, there's people under the stage, there's people on the stage, there's people on the sets. And to have that all come together in a moment is really electrifying. And I've been chasing it kind of ever since in the business world. Because alignment is so clear in an artistic endeavor, especially a performance like, you know, opera or theater or whatever, where literally you have to do it together. Hmm. There's no sort of like handing your homework down the assembly line. and having it work out.
Everyone has to literally play their part.
They have to show up. They have to play their part. They have to respond to the reality, which is this wonderful analogy for what we do in business. It's just that the delays are so real. You know, like communication is hard. Alignment is hard. Creation is hard. But in a, you know, in an orchestra or in an opera company, it's so agile because everyone's just organized around that kind of centerpiece. And I found that just really, really fun. You know, so I did it for money for a while, but also built a marketing business on the side to pay the rent.
How was that transition facilitated?
Jacob, you're so impressive. I'm just like in awe.
We knew that already, Elisa.
I know, but like...
Well, it's not super impressive, guys. It was like someone was, you know, I'd gone to Carnegie Mellon. So there was like, and I grew up like many of us, what do they call it? The Oregon Trail generation, mm-hmm. people who kind of had one foot in analog and one foot in digital. Yeah. I remember when I got both an email address and a cell phone, they weren't just always there. They were really big deals, you know, like Windows 95 launch. I remember it. Totally. Like that was really cool. And so, you know, I was always attracted to computers. They were just exciting, right? Just like video games. And so I'd learned enough HTML in my intro to HTML class at Carnegie Mellon that when someone said, hey, could you build me a website? I was like, for $200? And they said, sure. So I was like, that sounds like a great thing. So I figured out how to do that. But I wasn't really into the coding or design aspect of it. What I was really into in the end was using digital tools to help drive a business became kind of a short circuit for me. I was able to get into people's businesses because they were trying to embrace digital marketing and websites and SEO and e-commerce. But really fundamentally, they were wrestling with how their business was changing, how people wanted to buy. And I thought that was the cat's meow. I thought that was so cool. And so I ended up, you know, parlaying my sort of cheap websites business into a sort of full service digital marketing business focused on what I thought was originally anyone who wanted to pay me money, and then ultimately became a niche around luxury goods. So if you sold rare books or rare art or rare wine, you were willing to invest pretty heavily to find one customer, which I really thought made sense.
At the time also was smart, right? Because it was very hard to scale probably in those days, like an Amazon, right? Yeah. For mass, but the niche like that, that's cool.
The niche was good. And it was more about, so I remember I had a rare books dealer in London as one of my first, not first customers, but one of my first in that mold. And, you know, he was like, you just get me one more customer that looks like this, they'll spend a couple $1 million with me. I was like, oh, can do. Mm-hmm. Like, so he was less concerned about spending and investing, frankly, in his brand or investing in technology or investing in content because he just had to capture one more person to build a collection with. That was an eye-opener that I took right into my B2B technology career.
Yeah, welcome to B2B.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to B2B, especially if you retain customers. You're getting millions of dollars out of an acquisition, you know, if you have the right kinds of products. You're not getting hundreds of dollars. And so the idea of investing towards that to me as a marketer, which I guess by that time I had kind of found that as a description, was liberating because it took me out of the box of can you make me a website or can you make me an ad and put me into that, how can you help drive this business for me, which... that's what really excites me.
I'm a big proponent of creating your own path as you go and taking all of those key learnings and bringing, you talk about showing up, bringing your whole self to everything that you do. So you're a bassoonist, you're bringing that discipline, that passion to technology, to business, and all of that general background that you have really just creates this beautiful canvas for you to continue to paint on.
I did have a mentor who said, don't try to be unique, try to be special. You know, like you're representing a brand. And that's really stuck with me and everything. You know, certainly when I was jumping into the venture-backed technology business, I mean, 58 VCs told me and my brother, you're crazy. And then one finally said yes. And so it wasn't like we were pursuing the obvious idea. In fact, they were like, why would you go and compete with Amazon and Google and Microsoft, the biggest companies in the world? And we're like, well, we're not. But also, they were saying, how do you get customers to find and trust you? And you don't do that by being a copycat. You do that by creating affinity and trust and people really believing in you. And that's stuff you earn usually through showing up and attracting people to you and you know, promising things and then delivering on those promises. I mean, it's not rocket science, but creativity is an extra special ingredient in that because it really can help you, yes, stand out, but also be memorable. Have someone go like, you know, that was really interesting versus just like, what's the ROI, you know? Yeah, totally. And I think that that's, you do have to have those cards in your deck if you're going to go compete in any meaningful industry.
I take it you've never invested in startups before. And so, and I hear various things about starting VCs and being a VC. Mm-hmm. And so like, sure. I guess, what's the strategy and kind of what are you looking for?
I'm so glad you asked. I actually was thinking to rename it because we have my brother and I started something. It's kind of like a little family fund called Humans of the Internet, right? Which is HODI.VC. And I was like, we got to change that from, it's not venture, you know, it's collaboration. We're not venture capital. We're venture community. We're venture collaboration. We're actually not professional VCs. I never want to be one. It's a hard job. Someone else can do it. But I do have a real passion, and my brother, Zach, shares this probably more so than me, is investing in the people who are creating what's next and helping them not make the same mistakes we did. Right? Make new mistakes maybe, but not the same ones. It's a tough go to come and create change. It's a tough go to do it in the areas that we're passionate about, like internet infrastructure, open source, sustainability. And so we've just, first of all, we love investing in founders. Some people buy boats. I write $25,000 checks to people starting new disruptive businesses. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it will return fine, but that's actually not my business. I'm pretty bad VC when it comes to like evaluating a deal. And I'm like more interested in investing in people. And sometimes you need a check. And sometimes you just need someone who's going to give you honest feedback or connect you to the right next person or, you know, really show up and help you write the proposal to that big customer that you got on the line.
Oh, so you jump in at that level, basically?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, other, you know, VC firms have evolved to include a lot of those kind of services now. I can just do it, I think, at least he said, authentically. Like, I'm going to do it anyways. Like, if someone called and asked me to help them on something, I probably would just do it, you know?
Yeah.
I'm very giving, mainly, I mean, because that's my personality, but also because it's paid off for me always. Mm-hmm. It's just like a good bet. It's like usually like really being thoughtful and meaningful to someone and taking them seriously on their journey. You're planting a seed, you know, and you're creating a reservoir of goodwill that you can tap into. And that comes back at you. I think it's Danny Meyer, the guy who Shake Shack and, if you haven't read his book, Setting the Table, it's a great business book. But he talks about ABCD, always be collecting the dots so you can always be connecting the dots. And that sense of just like planting seeds, getting information, being in the soup so that you can create magic, you know, to me is exciting. And I just do it naturally. So it's good that it also kind of
helps.
Pays off in the end, you know.
One of the reasons why we wanted to have you on the podcast, Jacob, is because working with you, we got to see a lot of your magic at work. We got to see the fruits probably of years of labor. We were there like during the celebration period, which is great. But something we experienced with you was your unconventional approach to B2B marketing. And you had a lot of really cool things. You created a community out of the community just for creators through Origins. You created the Traceroute podcast, which is narrative storytelling, not necessarily as a marketing tool, but there were a lot of community type things that you did. So if you could like wrap that all up into some kind of secret sauce for B2B marketing, what would you call it?
Well, that particularly I would call the 80-20 rule. So I've always used something 70-30, 80-20, it doesn't matter. Pick your number. but that there's like a large percentage of the activity, money, time that you spend on things that you know work, right? That have a direct result on the business, that are sort of proven tools in your tool set. That should be the majority of your work, but it can't be all of it because there's things that you haven't discovered that could work. You might call them rock star moves, big bets, whatever you want, but I have always encouraged and looked mainly through a budgeting process that, like, are you spending 30% of your time, especially if you're early or early to a market or need to kind of get some noise made on truly aggressive experimentation, like really off the wall ideas. I think Intel, which is a long innovator in the world, has this way of brainstorming that they bring everyone in a room together and say, give us your ideas that are bold, crazy, and going to get you fired today. Because, you know, most people calibrate against the room and they kind of like figure out what's acceptable and in the norm. And so I like to carve space with my teams and frankly with other leaders because they often just, they don't just want marketing to be transactional. They just want that thing. And so carving out room, budget, time for that intentional experimentation, which we expect to not work. Yeah. Right? We expect it. The numbers aren't in our favor here. We're not trying to win it. But, you know, we're going to learn. We're going to get some new things out there. That's a really important tool to keep people kind of flexing, right? And yeah. to maybe find something to put in that tool set. So that's my first one. And for instance, you know, doing something like a podcast was maybe not kind of bold now, but like for us to tell stories that weren't about getting clicks on a thing.
It still is though, Jacob, a branded podcast in B2B. I mean, it's happening. It's not like it's not happening, but it's not
very
everywhere
rare still,
for sure.
But it really came out of me deciding to spend a few $100,000 of a budget on something important. So that's really how it came about. The other thing is I've always really felt with B2B and that idea of being special, that what you do is you hire the best possible people that you can, usually creatives. The creatives are cheap. And I don't mean that as they should be cheap, but they often are. So like, for instance, one thing we did when we were figuring out how to really be relevant to the cloud native community, which is a big part of our world during COVID, you know, all the big events, KubeCon was canceled. And so we had an artist. I hired an author who had, you know, done all these novels. And, you know, I paid her like $20,000 and said, go write a cookbook, like collect the recipes, but go write a beautiful cookbook with this illustrator and let's do it. You know, and it's like, it was cheap, you know, it was a couple, I mean, it's like how many Google ads?
But that was probably an amazing opportunity for her.
Right.
Like $20,000 to write a cookbook. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and look, so you're talking about effectively marketing innovation, like stuff that really, the big, like, you know, the payoff, right? But the truth is, Jacob, you're also, at least from my perspective, in our interactions, your 80% is also more creative than a lot of others that I've seen, just by way of example of like, you know, even from a branding perspective, I think you had us do a deep dive on like mascots, right? The idea of mascots and using a mascot and branding. And like, is that the most cutting edge? Is that your 20%? No. But when you talk about branding for the 80%, I saw a pattern with you a lot of times where I was like, that's interesting. That's creative. You know what I mean? Like, that's innovative, you know? Like, so I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Everything was special.
No, on the 80%, right?
So I did stretch the 80% to be more. I've personally found it easier to be a divergent thinker than a convergent thinker when it comes to marketing. It's just easier. I'm not a naturally deep technical person. I'll give you that example. When I started Packet, it was a bunch of people who'd been living in the data center. And I was like, what did you just say? I don't even understand what a NIC is. And they're like, what are you talking about? So like they would say words, I wouldn't understand them. And that made me think as a marketer, part of my role was translation, right? I had the opportunity, but also the responsibility to turn jargon into something that people didn't feel like they were, you know, like, oh, I'm too stupid. I don't know that what that is. You know, like that's part of the
makes it so much more approachable.
And so some of that kind of like 80% for me was always, it's not just about making it palatable, but like we can be savvy and also not turn people away. We can be, you know, we find our tone, and that's, I guess you would call it brand and voice and all those things. But asking people to kind of think about that in their daily day, I don't see that as 20% stuff. I see that as like just part of building your brand properly. A little easier to see that as bold, Corey, when you're working at a Fortune 200. And I just felt that was opportunity, right? That was opportunity to kind of play with a big traditional brand that most people didn't know about. You'd say Equinix, people'd say Equinox, you know, you're like the gym, you're like, no, the data center company, you're like, what's that, right? So that presented an opportunity to stand out, which is, frankly, I had a lot of fun. So.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned Packet, and for the audience, that was the company that you and your brother built and sold to Equinix.
Yeah.
And speaking of Packet, how did you kind of like, what was the, I don't know if it's marketing hacks or marketing, like what was some unlocks from a B2B marketing perspective that helped build that business that ideally that are relevant today, you know what I mean, for in today's B2B marketing world?
So there's plenty of stuff that didn't work, but we had a sign on the door that, you know, virtual door, but basically $0 on Google Ads. Right? That was the first thing that I was like, let's challenge ourselves not to do demand generation, because the main thing we needed to accomplish was establish trust. That was the biggest thing. And I still think that that's relevant for B2B.
Definitely.
If you're going to enterprise, you're trying to get that gazillionaire who's going to spend a lot of money on the books, you know, you're getting to a point where they want to do something meaningful with you. And when we were starting Packet, which was a bare metal cloud, for lack of better words, people were going to put their most important applications on our infrastructure. It's not like, oh, well, it didn't work is an okay answer. They needed to really believe it. And so trust building was a really important thing to do. So of course you had to be authentic. You can't say things that just sound like marketing but aren't true. You can't really just do the, it's better over here, click now, faster. Like that just doesn't work for a sophisticated buyer, right? And so being honest and sort of being ahead of that ball, like basically, of course people were going to be like, well, are you better than AWS? And my answer was like, no, we're different. You know, we're not better. Like, we're just a startup. We have a few million dollars of funding. They're a $20 billion juggernaut. Like, what do you mean? But just even be able to say that kind of stuff and position yourself, I call that being savvy.
You were just like your own rare books, luxury goods company that you were marketing.
Figured it out. And then I had a framework, which I think every marketer should have a framework. Like I said, I'm a revenue guy, not a marketing guy, but let's just say everyone needs to think like a CRO in go-to-market. So let's pretend we're all CROs, even if we're sales or customer success or marketing. And for me, that was a flywheel. Like I wanted to get a flywheel going. And I really believe that that's the way, especially for big, durable businesses. And, you know, for me, that kind of framework was really broad buckets. Like, I think the first bucket was like awareness. The second, like, if they don't know who you are, like, they can't buy from you. The second bucket was like research. Like, they're going to have to learn more. Then there's adoption. There was growth. There was loyalty. And then there was advocacy. So my goal as a marketer was to move you through that journey confidently, quickly. And some people come in super hot. The early adopters, they're already there, right? They want to be there. Other people, maybe Bank of America, just takes longer, right? Yeah. But it's the same goal. I use that framework and I modeled it, and this maybe, Corey, is useful for you and at least on your own company, is that I had the same wheel, but for both customer journey and for employee journey. I felt it's the same thing. Like we're just bringing people into this is what we're trying to do here. This is what we're all about thing. And so we're moving from like, now I know about you, to like, I'm your loyal fan. And even if I don't work from you or buy from you, I'm still going to say, these people are legit. Right? So for me, having a framework like that really helps you in two ways. One, it helps you organize your work because it's such a big effort to build a brand new B2B company. And second of all, especially in the tech space, you're often working with technical partners and co-founders who've never they don't understand go-to-market, let alone marketing, right? And so having a philosophy or a framework or something that you can literally show. Okay, so you know how that you make software and you go through this and then you do testing and then staging and production? Well, this is how we do building a brand from scratch. And it helps people organize their thoughts and understand versus just throwing out like, why aren't we doing PR? Or what are we doing with the podcast, you know, I mean, those are all good. Now we can say, oh, well, where does that kind of fit in our framework, in our philosophy? So that was mine.
Did you build that into like budgetary level? Like, did you oftentimes, was that the theme in all your decks and like all of your, a lot of your presentations to, you know, this and that? And
yeah. I mean, you know, one thing with both Packet and then actually with Equinix, it was the same deal as we launched new products and services, is that we just had a lot of work to do on the awareness side. And everyone's like, oh, that's very expensive. Don't want to do a big brand campaign. I'm like, I'm sorry. They don't know who you are. So either you could do the big brand campaign or we could find creative ways. Like, let's go get a taco truck and invite everyone to the data center. I don't know. Like, also fine. You know, like, it doesn't have to be through any one particular tactic. But if people don't know who we are, it's very unlikely that they're going to one day spend millions of dollars with us. Just thinking out loud here. So we had like a lot of work to do on awareness. And then, of course, yeah, research. Is that like about like documentation and product? Yeah, it's a lot of it. Or is it about like when they talk to a customer success person or a salesperson, they have something to hand them? Yeah, okay. So you can kind of start to divvy up where you think your strengths and weaknesses are and where your moments of acceleration are. Like, where can we go faster with a particular, you know, persona? You know, the developer might go zoom, zoom, self-service, you know, whereas an enterprise buyer might need a lot of people involved in the research part. They want to do a POC. They want you to do it for them, right? Like, okay, that's just a different pacing and level of investment.
Yeah, and it's really cool now working with your former marketing team that they use your framework. So like you say all the phases, and I've seen that chart many times, because that's then for us as an agency, we're trying to meet those same goals for you and create those meaningful connections on your behalf. And it is rare to find that approach in the corporate space that we are in. And even for myself, working with a couple of innovative tech companies, finding that I keep calling it like a secret sauce, but there are so many B2B marketing frameworks out there. There are so many. And this one, I really think works.
This is more of a go-to-market framework than a marketing framework, just to be clear. It is really one step above. I find, though, if every function in go-to-market and also in non-go-to-market and product understands what we're trying to do, that then we can apply particular tactics and skills and superpowers. But what you're missing, and what I think we are struggling with, is like this is a CRO mindset with a product mindset, too. I actually think they are also, I mean, especially in product-led growth, but like users now, I mean, let's go back to Danny Meyer. Danny Meyer talks about restaurants and he talks about front of house and back of house. Like back of house, a lot of the things that used to be back of house are now front of house. Like things like you used to, I don't know, have to get a quote from someone and that was like behind a wall with lots of layers of things. Now that's just like on the website, right? And so like the front of house, which I believe is everything from like, you found out about the restaurant, they took your code at the door, you figured out what you wanted to eat and order, you got it, you liked it, you paid your bill, you know, like you transacted for the value there, and then you left a Google review afterward. That's all to me front of house. I believe you can't run a great restaurant without an awesome back of house. But that a lot of the traditional things have moved forward. And so like, you know, taking ownership over that and saying like, we're going to deliver you an awesome experience tonight. Of course, it's easier in a restaurant because you're giving them food, or in an opera, which is like, did it sound good? Did you cry? But with B2B anything, I think you're ultimately having to think holistically about, because customers don't really want to hear about your the problems with your fish supplier. Like that's just not acceptable excuse. You have to be the one to tell them. But, you know, you're going out there to win the game. And if the coaches and the sports trainers and the, you know, everyone else involved isn't doing their part, you're probably not going to win.
The customer journey today, again, back to disruption, the customer journey today is completely different than it was probably even 5 years ago, you know, and the wall between front of the house and back, everything's front of the house. They know everything. You're really just a steward. You're an advisor, you know, like you need to build trust.
I always say, I boil it down. You want to like make it as simple as possible. I think it's all about like setting the promise, like delivering or transacting on the promise and delivering the promise, depending which order you go. But like we set a promise to the market. It's a hard thing to do, but it ultimately, you hope it gets out there. And then we have to go deliver on it. Like, it's that simple. And so this whole idea about tactics, it's important. There's like a lot of ways into people's hearts and budgets. But in the end, you have to create a desire for them to change. Like going back to Walter White. Like, change has to exist. So are you displacing someone's budget? Are they coming in and choosing you for a new thing? It's hard. It's a people thing. And you guys sometimes have some wind in your sails, like AI. Okay, I sell AI stuff. Great. Awesome. How do we spend the money with you? But ultimately, I think you have to have a commitment to, you know, really creating a durable value with your customers and building the relationships that, you know, make them want to do business with you.
That's, I think, well, that's a beautiful way to close. And also on Walter White.
Well, I actually have a question for both of you. It's a coaching question.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
Okay. So I want you to think for both of you. Don't think about our listeners. I want you to think about only yourself. Okay? So, Jacob, out of everything you've said today, what was a highlight for you? And even just for yourself, did anything like come up for you? Did you get any ahas behind the scenes of your own talking today?
I'm allowed to say two things because you can't stop me.
You're a guest.
One, I really loved that you and I, like that your dad played in music, and that when I said show up on time and don't play in the rest, you got it, because that was such a kernel for me that I carried through since I was a young person as to like how to move forward in life. And I really value that. I have a friend who gave me a tagline, like his business card says, show up, add value, have fun. Like, this is like that. Key to life and business. And I love that because it really tied into that show up and don't play in the effing rests, which my teacher told me, which is a little bit defensive. So, you know, maybe we like this other one better. So that felt really cool that you kind of understood from a musical family. Mm-hmm. But what I should probably do more work on this, but the fact that my, you know, former team and other people like are getting benefit out of using a framework that it wasn't just me. I didn't just pop it out of my head, but like, that kind of stretch to be holistic and take ownership over a customer journey in that sense, like you're the maitre d', like, how do you want this to flow? I really love it, and I'm glad that other people find it useful, and I should probably go back and spend more time working on it and seeing if it's as good as it could be. You know?
Corey, what about you? I know you have a novel inside your mind right now.
I think it's fascinating, the path that you took. And that it's, you've kind of built a career, and you find yourself in a place that's very enviable for a lot of people starting out or mid-career or late career or whatever. And it all started from as a creative, you know, building a creative agency on your own. I feel like there's probably, I'd be curious to know how many of your alumni of that, early career stage are out there. I run a creative agency, so I found it particularly fascinating.
Well, never hesitate to hire someone who's done something like sports or music or art or theater or military. I mean, I really believe those skills are so hard to teach, and we hired people all the time to come in who had no business. They didn't know anything about what we were doing, but I knew that they were capable to learn, to show up, to collaborate. Those are like gold. That sense, like, you're not just born with creativity and someone has and someone don't. You can just work on it. And I think that that's a really exciting place for a lot of people to spend time, because you grow. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jacob. This is awesome. I'm definitely going to have my dad listen to this because he'll love it also.
B2B Creatively is powered by Stories Bureau. This episode was produced by Alexandra Uresta with help from Mather Dillian. It was engineered and mixed by Tim Ballant and edited by Joshua Ramsey. If you like what you hear, go follow Stories Bureau on LinkedIn, or Elisa, Corey, and the rest of the team are dishing out tips all week long. Or maybe check out storiesbureau.com. Sign up for our newsletter, and that'll keep you up to date on all the latest trends and best practices in the B2B creative, design, and marketing worlds. Oh, and of course, follow us on YouTube and your favorite podcast platform to get more creative convos like this delivered straight to your feed every month. That's it for this one. So until next time, Thanks for listening.